Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Cleanna Lightborn.
And I'm Eric Newton. Tonight we have a live interview with Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter.
We'll also hear part one of a three-part collar work segment by Justin Baker.
Afterwards, we'll speak to environmental activist Barbara Heinzel about a local clean air initiative.
And later on, we'll hear about clandestine relationships with Daryl Davis. Let's start the show off with some headlines.
A judge in California ruled Thursday that U.S. authorities cannot force people to unlock technology via fingerprint or facial recognition, even with a search warrant. Magistrate Judge Candace Westmore of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California made the ruling as investigators tried to access someone's property in Oakland.
A federal judge in New York on Thursday barred the Trump administration from adding a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman ruled that while a question on citizenship would be constitutional, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had added it arbitrarily and did not follow proper procedure. The ruling comes after a three-week trial in November.
Congressional Democrats on Tuesday rejected President Trump's invitation to a lunch meeting at the White House to discuss border security, in the latest sign that both sides of the government shutdown standoff remained entrenched in their positions with no compromise in sight.
After spanning the Hudson River for more than six decades, a chunk of the old Tappan Zee Bridge was toppled in a controlled blast Tuesday to the delight of hundreds of onlookers. A couple hundred people braved the cold to witness the bridge's last hurrah and held out their cell phones to record the big moment.
The number of airport security screeners failing to show up for work around the country is soaring as the partial government shutdown goes into its fourth week. The Transportation Security Administration reported a national absence rate of 7.6%, compared with 3.2% on a comparable day a year ago. Monday marked the first business day after screeners did not receive a paycheck for the first time since the shutdown began. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004 or follow us online or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary.
We are joined in the studio once again by the one-man media mogul, the creator of Troy Letter, Luke Stoddard Nathan. Welcome back to the show, Luke. What's new this week?
Hey, thank you. I'm going to use that tagline, I think, moving forward. What's new? Well, here's something that's new that wasn't even in the last Troy letter because it happened after I sent it out on Friday. The city put out an announcement on, and generally, you know, a little tangent before I even start. Generally, when governments aren't trying to tout news, then the stuff goes out on a Friday afternoon, mm-hmm. and that's what happened here. The city announced that the Mount Ida Lake Dam, which is a saga that I've been following, basically the engineers have recently discovered some cracks. That's not a technical term, but some cracks in the wooden structure of the dam. And they've recommended that the city wants to basically do a partial deconstruction of the dam in order to kind of alleviate pressure. Especially they're concerned that if there were to be some sort of flood event, the dam could break, and that would be, you know, potentially cause some property damage, to say the least. And there's been some neighborhood concern about it, so much that the city has already been having these monthly meetings of the city council has been having monthly meetings about it. Anyway, the city put out an announcement on Friday that basically said that they're going to move forward with that plan to deconstruct part of the dam as soon as possible. It didn't give a date or a definite time frame, but it gave the sense, especially from what we already know, that it is pretty imminent. The city actually confirmed that they had had a meeting earlier this month with DEC, the Army Corps of Engineers, and Ampersand Energy. That's the owner of the hydroelectric dam that's just downstream from the dam, and that is the interested party that has been also quite concerned about the city's plan, because they're basically concerned that sediment, either from during the process of the city doing this work, mm-hmm. some kind of sediment could get kind of stirred up and get into the facility's gears or, you know, or their equipment or whatever. After this meeting, I guess I should say too, that the Ampersand had even wanted, they had commissioned their own study of the dam, not actually going on site, but with a different engineering firm, but just looking at the city's engineering firm's like report. Mm-hmm. And they basically concluded that actually you don't have to do this emergency work. But I guess in any case, their mind was changed, or they eventually agreed, because from what the city said in this announcement on Friday, all the parties are now kind of on the same page, and they're going to proceed with this work kind of as the city initially intended to. Here are the next steps, just for your information. First, the contractor is going to kind of work to construct a channel under the dam. Then it's going to remove sediment that is accumulated on the dam structure. Then the middle of the dam is going to be slowly removed so that there's not a drastic change in water level. And then the water will kind of slowly kind of drain from the Mount Ida Lake, which is kind of what neighbors have been concerned about, because not only, I think, largely because of how it is going to look. You know, there was this large lake there. You could drive out and see it. Now it's not going to be there. And so people are concerned, you know, about also the environmental impacts, which the city is basically exempted from kind of taking into consideration because it's emergency work and sort of life and safety is at stake, I guess. So they're allowed to do it, and the Army Corps and DEC have, you know, signed off on it. And indeed, DEC is basically mandating that the city do this work now. So all that's going to happen. And as I reported a couple of weeks ago, let me back up. The city also has been adamant that it has no long-term plan for the dam, they haven't decided, you know, whether they're going to permanently decommission this dam once it's taken apart, or whether they're going to rebuild it. And if they do rebuild it, you know, what are they going to make it out of? Are they going to rebuild it out of wood, which is sort of a kind of antiquated kind of approach to building mm-hmm. a dam? Mm-hmm. Will they make it out of concrete? For what it's worth, the State Historic Preservation Office, because this dam is in a historic district, has already opined that they want to see a dam in that place, and they think that the dam is an important kind of part of the historic district's character, which I think the city had just gotten that news when I reported it last, and I haven't followed up, but it seems like that carries some weight as far as what the city is going to do next. So even though the city is adamant that it has no further plans, no like future kind of final plans, and they'll probably hold more public meetings about it, I think that SHPO's opinion or recommendation does hold a lot of weight. So I think, you know, you can probably expect that some sort of dam will have to be rebuilt in the future, but that's kind of getting ahead of things. So I don't know, I'll keep following this and try to make it over there when the city actually starts work on the dam. If it hasn't already, I haven't been there today. So
did they mention where the funds for it come from? Is there some sort of emergency fund that they can dip into?
Yeah,
for that?
Probably. I don't know. I know that this will probably, with the city taxpayers, or this is going to come from city funds in some way. I don't know that they'll be able to be reimbursed or anything, but you know, they had the initial way that they discovered this was because they were doing work on a FEMA funded project from hurricane damage from years ago. They were kind of doing preliminary investigative work to repair the abutments, which are the side of the dam, and then when they did this kind of cursory inspection, they found these other cracks, and so that sort of plan to do the abutments kind of fell by the wayside while they attended to this more kind of urgent matter. Speaking of, well, not really, not as urgent matters. This does not involve life or safety. last week, also, the city council authorized a new bond issuance for one project and tabled consideration of a bond issuance on another project. The one project that was approved was for Ingalls Avenue, the Ingalls Avenue boat launch. That's sort of right behind Italian bakery that everybody likes, right near kind of in the 700 range.
Bellinapoli?
Yes, Bellinapoli. Thank you. So this project has already is basically completely or was going to be completely. No, I'm sorry. I mixed. Yes, was going to be or rather is state funded, I believe, from a sort of patchwork of funds. But apparently because of one, they discovered on the ground portion of the work a lot of concrete buried underneath the ground because this was a former junkyard and God knows what else it was kind of serving as. So they needed more kind of funds to be able to remediate the site. And then also from the in-water work, I want to read a little bit of the planning commissioner's memo on this because it made me sort of, I was just kind of surprised by it. Additionally, this is me quoting from the memo. Additionally, bedrock under the river bottom sediment was found to be higher than anticipated in places, providing insufficient support for the sheet piling. This is like for the part of the in-water ramp for the, or I don't know if ramp is the technical term, but like for boats kind of getting into the water. Mm-hmm. Buried debris undetected in the bathymetric survey, such as cars, complicated the matter. A new plan to use permanent sheeting for the concrete boat launch form was considered the most preferred plan of attack. So it's going to cost, you know, another $65,000. So they have found during the course of doing this work and also during the course of doing the big kind of $17 million seawall repair work that's also kind of ongoing in the city. They've found cars in the Hudson.
Wow. As is tradition, when it gets old, you push it into the Hudson.
The contractor before the meeting, I asked him like how many, and he said they found three cars. One was a Buick, he said, but the others, I don't know if they identified what they were. I asked him, you know, what he thought or how did those cars get there, and he sort of didn't want to speculate. We can all speculate, I guess. I have no idea how that happens. I guess, you know, that particular site right near there was a junkyard, so maybe one rolled in. I have no idea. But I thought that was just so bizarre. Anyway, that project, the Ingalls Ave boat launch, is about 75% complete, so I guess it's sort of on schedule. The other project that didn't get approval was the Powers Park rehabilitation. This is a sort of historic park. It's kind of similar. This is up in Lansingburg. If you're not familiar with this park, Washington Park, the private park, Powers Park is not private. It's open to the public, but it's about the same size and of about the same era. It kind of has the fence isn't in as good shape, and there's indeed, I think, one side of the fence is completely missing, but they want to restore that sort of wrought iron fence thing and kind of do some work on the these pathways that are through the park. I think as it is, it's sort of an adequate park, but it's sort of underutilized and also maybe could use a little bit of sprucing up. And this is also, it was going to be basically state funded through a grant, about $500,000. But bids came back closer. The lowest bid, rather, came back at like $600,000. Then the city basically asked the council to approve another $300,000 in bonding. So city taxpayers then would be essentially borrowing to be able to pay for those repairs to the park. And I think that figure was just a bridge too far for a bunch of members of the council. They sort of balked and thought that was just, you know, they were like, it's a nice idea that you want to fix up this park, but that's just way too much money. We just bonded, you know, the city just bonded for two swimming pools in the latest sort of budget deliberations. And so I think they were just kind of like, go back to the drawing board, and the administration eventually relented and said, okay, fine. We'll take a look at it. We'll see if we can pare down the kind of maybe take a look at some of the trimmings for this park and maybe not try to spend so much money. So that's, again, we'll keep tabs and see when that comes back, and they'll probably have to put it out to bid again. They're going to have to go back to the state to get like approval to modify the plans because it's already basically state funded. So that is a big mess. And then if I have time, the one other big city project in Lansingburg, again, not city project, private sector project, is the former Standard Manufacturing Building. This is at 750 Second Avenue, right around 120th Street. The building takes up a whole block, and there have been plans already approved by the Planning Commission to convert the upper floors of this building into apartments while keeping the first floor or the ground floor retail that includes like a uniform company, you know, like textile kind of stuff. And the owners of that building, that business there, are also members of an LLC that owns the building, and another member of that LLC has I'm going to speak in broad strokes because it's a fairly complicated lawsuit, but a member of that LLC that owns the building has sued the other members of that LLC, basically saying that he's been cut out of the ongoing effort to redevelop that property. So he basically says that the other members of that LLC have made deals related to the building without him, or created other LLCs to deal with the redevelopment of that property without him, applied for historic tax credits without him. And basically, by doing all these things that are alleged, those other members have diluted this member's interest in the LLC. Anyway, long story short, it seems like I guess I'm interested in it because it's a huge building. It would be a big deal for Lansingburg if this property were to be redeveloped. It's big, hulking warehouse, one of the last huge kind of warehouses in Troy, I guess, that hasn't been developed into housing at this point, or been put into a more kind of productive use. You know, not far from there at 701 River Street, Redburn Development is also in the process of, you know, converting that old warehouse into housing, and, you know, with retail on the bottom. So it's a trend that we're seeing in Troy, or that we've seen over the past couple of years, but it seems like this lawsuit at the very least could, you know, delay that effort. And so I'll be following to see, you know, what the other members of the LLC say in response to this lawsuit, whether they say it's, you know, they didn't respond when I reached out, or one member of the LLC that was named in the lawsuit didn't respond. So we'll see what they say in response, and whether they think it's, you know, spurious, or whether a court finds that there's some merit to it. I guess we'll see. Do we still have time?
We have a couple minutes.
You can read more of about this next thing in the last Troy letter. There's a weird lawsuit that has now made its way to the appellate court in the state of New York that oversees courts in Rensselaer County, as well as many other counties in this general region. The case involves RPI. RPI is a neighbor of a professor that also owns a property next door. This is on a street right near RPI's campus. And RPI has sued the neighbor, who's also, again, an professor
there, right?
of RPI, saying to try to obtain a judicial decision that says that RPI has the right, it's called a prescriptive easement, has the right to use about 2 feet of this professor's property. Basically, because RPI says that the driveway of their property is such that when you park in RPI's driveway and open your door, you have to step onto this RPI professor's property. And the RPI professor has grown to not like this. And they had even put up, they didn't call it a fence, they called it a boundary marker, but basically a couple of stakes and a little chain that marked where the property line is, that RPI says prevented people, tenants of this RPI property, from being able to open their door and walk out and exit their vehicle, and thus walking onto the RPI professor's property. It's amazing to me, and this is sort of one of the reasons that I included it in the last letter, that this litigation has made it to the second highest court in the state of New York. But you know, property rights disputes, man, they can get they can get acrimonious.
Really,
and it's an interesting case. RPI won at the county level, or at the lower court ruling. They ruled in favor of RPI, basically saying that yes, because RPI or previous owners of this building had allegedly been using this driveway for more than 10 years and basically using it openly. There's apparently a phrase,
yeah,
like open and notorious, which I love. If the use of someone else's property is open and notorious, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm, you know, this is my understanding. If you're using a property openly and notoriously for 10 years, then you basically get that, you have that easement, basically you have that right to use that property in such a way. So the court said, yes, RPI has this prescriptive easement. The professor appealed. And so now it was just argued at the third department, the appellate division that handles cases from Rensselaer County. So in a month or two, we'll know. And I know, and I, for one, will be waiting with bated breath to find out, you know, whether RPI is really allowed to have this, or whether it'll be reversed. And then, you know, who knows? Maybe it could go to the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York State, or maybe, you know, and then from there, maybe the Supreme Court, hopefully.
And where can people go to follow your story?
You can email me, luke.s.nathan@gmail.com, and just say I want Troy Letter and I can sign you up, or tinyletter.com/Troy_letter. You can also sign up there.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Luke, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you for having me.
This segment of ColorWorks Radio features Madison LaValle discussing her work with Justin Baker. This is part one of a three-part interview.
Hi, this is Justin Baker, again with ColorWorks Radio. And with me today is artist, educator, curator, all around super guy, Jason Cates Van Staveren. How you doing, Jason?
Pretty good, thanks. Hello.
Good. All right. So today, in the segment we're doing today, we're going to talk to him about what he's doing as an artist, as a curator, and anything he's got coming up. Or I know you have a show that just is wrapping up that you had curated. And where was that again? That was in Oneana?
Yeah,
it's right?
It's a place called Kano, which is, I've forgotten what it stands for, but if you Google Kano, C-A-N-O, it'll come right up. They have a gallery there called the Wilbur Mansion. It's this retrofitted Victorian mansion. It's pretty great space.
Okay. And how did you, I'm just curious, when did you get that opportunity, or how did that come to you?
Yeah, they have an open call for proposals every year. In fact, it just went out for the next year last week.
Okay.
And I just responded to that and wrote a proposal. The show is called A House and Home, and it's about sort of the simultaneous conjunction and distinction between those terms, house and home. And I really wanted it to be in that gallery because it's a house, and it seemed like really fitting that that would be in that space.
Okay, so yeah, conceptually it tied into the theme of the show. Now that show is closing soon, but how does any of those ideas, or what was the idea of house and home? How does that tie into, like, maybe what you're doing as an artist, or maybe you want to explain like your process a little bit about what you do?
Oh, geez. To be quite frank, the thing began as an excuse to show some of my own work, actually, that I made a long time ago. These photographs of houses with collected ephemera in the margin of the photograph. I really liked them and I wanted to show them. And so I just sort of reached out to a bunch of other artists I knew who made work that I felt was sort of thematically tied together somehow. And I got some of them on board and I proposed shows like that for the last several years and finally got this one approved. And the list of people had changed a little bit every year, but the idea was always about what does it mean for a house to be a home, and how is that definition different for different folks, and what are our relationships with that space and what the space is physically and emotionally, and just trying to showcase a variety of takes on those ideas.
Right. So, right. How, like, the architecture that we, like, define as, like, a space becomes something more, like, mentally, like, feasible or, like, you know, important to us, like the importance we put on a physical space.
Yeah. For me, it's, memory is really tied up in it, 'cause I'm primarily a photographer. And so it's always about making things from the past, documenting things that have already been. So the idea of, so I sort of approach the whole framing from the position of looking at things that were no longer. So a bunch of the artists who are in the show are dealing with things from the past and sort of finding a way to frame what happened in your life based on that architecture, or the architecture sort of holding on to those memories. If you see that outline of that door again, it brings back those memories, and I find that really powerful. Mm.
Now, I know I was a little privy to your process, because I recently sat through an artist talk that you had given at Hudson Valley, and you talked a lot about in your process, like, the idea of, it wasn't really totally truth, because that sounds too, like, all-encompassing, but the idea of a document being fiction, right?
Yeah, I think interestingly enough, this work that show is based on sort of predated that stuff, or was that, it was, this work was made when I began sort of changing my position on the idea of, especially photographic truth. I really, for a long time, subscribed to the idea that a photograph was this really honest document, that it had a lot of fidelity, and that was to be embraced. And I've come to sort of change my tune on that. And the things I'm doing now are all about sort of capitalizing on that idea of photographic truth and making up fictions instead that masquerade as really believable truths. So yeah, those are two sort of different voices, I guess.
Yeah. I found it super interesting because I knew it before, but you kind of really came from this documentarian background. And in my mind, that's all about kind of presenting a truth, you know? But then during your talk, it kind of, you know, became this really different approach to telling stories that was about fiction, which I found really kind of powerful. For those people tuning in right now, I'm here talking with Jason Cates Van Stavern, a local artist, curator, and educator. My name is Justin Baker, and this is a short segment I'm doing for Colorworks Radio. So going back to your newest kind of like curatorial ideas, do you want to talk about that, like how you transitioned into that role? I know from my experience living in upstate New York, I live in Troy, the art scene is, you know, kind of small. And if you want to get something done, you kind of have to do it yourself. But maybe you can talk about your approach to that in some way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. This is that show, the Kano show, The House and Home. That's only the second show I've ever actually curated that wasn't a two-person show with me and a friend. And I'm really loving doing it. And I worked for a long time as a video editor, and for me, video editing made sense the way mixtapes made sense, and curating makes sense the way video editing makes sense to me. Those things all are about sort of finding things that are already there, or making things that weren't already there, and then putting them together to become this even cooler, larger whole. And I'm really loving doing it. And it's a great chance to sort of invite myself over to people's studios and see what they make and be inspired by that. I don't know. the Oneonta show, that was the second half of this year. In the first half of this year, I curated a show in Hudson at a gallery called Concepto that was a really similarly executed curatorial effort. I just reached out to a ton of people who I already knew, I knew what they made, and I sort of asked them, hey, I think these things go together. Could we put them together in a show? Mm-hmm.
That was a really beautiful show.
Thanks.
Nice,
I loved it. It was really fun. So it becomes this sort of like cooperative effort where I just sort of like, I feel like I'm kind of pulling the ropes that people are already attached to, and just kind of tugging on them and going, hey, you guys, let's get together and do a cool thing. And it hasn't been, it's been really easy to do and exciting, yeah.
It's always surprising how quickly, because I've curated a few shows with Colorworks. I'm on the exhibition committee there, and I've taken the rein a few times. And in my mind, in the curatorial process of like selecting work and putting together themes and ideas, I'm always flattered and kind of surprised when people just say yes. Like I always kind of think like, why would they want to do this? Or, you know, what is it? You know, I mean, they always, obviously as an artist, you always want to show your work. But again, I'm always kind of surprised when someone's just, even if it's like a cold call, like I don't know them at all. I just like look at their work and I email them and they're like, yeah, I'd love to do it. It's always kind of flattering. But do you see this like in focusing or not really focusing, but as an artist and a curator, like do you see like a common thread in the types of shows you like putting together? Or is it really like just about what you're kind of looking at recently or what you're fond of?
Certainly it's so far it's been things I'm fond of, ideas that are already on my mind. I'm kind of an extension of what I would make. You know, it's kind of like an extra arm of I'm not making this, but I'm the gesture that would happen if I did make it is made by this curatorial effort. I have this thing that's begun in the works. I've contacted some people for another thing that I'm going to try to put together that is not like anything I've ever done. It's going to be made up of work that isn't, it's nothing that I would ever make. It's about things that I don't make things about. And that's going to be really, I'm really excited by that it's kind of a real departure. It's sort of the tracks between my own, the making of my own work and this curatorial thing. They're spreading further apart.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, I'm pumped on it. It's more of a challenge. You know, it's about things I don't already know about, sort of.
Okay. Well, we'll keep a lookout for it. And when you do it, we'll come back.
Great. All right.
Thank you, Jason. And again, this is Justin Baker with Collarworks Radio. Thank you.
That was Justin Baker with part one of a three-part segment on Collarworks Radio.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kleana Lightborn.
And I'm Eric Newton. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Barbara Heinzen is a long-term strategist and scenario planner with a successful 30-year practice working with corporations, government departments, and civil society organizations in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the USA. In recent years, she has been working on two multi-stakeholder projects concerning the future of energy, one in East Africa and the other in Pennsylvania, USA. In 2011, Barbara returned to the USA from central London after buying 20 acres of land along the Hudson River on the boundary of the town of Coymans and Baltimore, New York. Her property is also part of a larger experiment, learning to manage land for environmental benefit while creating economic returns for doing so. She is also a volunteer, environmental activist, and advocate in the community. And Barbara joins us now to talk about the town of Coymans' local law number one, Clean Air Bill. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Doing great, thank you.
And so we understand this local law is expected to come to a vote in the next few weeks. Can you tell us a bit more about this bill and why it's so important?
Yeah, this is a bill in the town of Coymans, so practice your pronunciation, please. and Coymans, about a year ago in December, got word that the Hartford, Connecticut had a proposal to send a considerable amount of their municipal trash to the Lafarge plant in Ravenna, which is part of Coymans, for burning. And this was just before Christmas, and there was a press conference organized between the town of Coymans and the county of Albany. And in that press conference, Judith Eng spoke and said, burning trash in a cement plant is very hazardous. You get very bad air emissions. These are bad for human health, and you don't want them in your town. So the objection to this proposal was quite severe, and the plan was dropped by the Connecticut authorities. They decided they would not send their trash for burning to the Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna. And that was over a year ago. Following that event, the town board asked the man who had alerted them that this was coming along to help them draft a law that is now the clean air law that's being considered in the town of Queemans. And that's what is going on now. It's just being sent for review to Albany County and should be coming back to the town in the next month or so.
And so when the town went to pass this or move to introduce this legislation, were they consulting outside groups for advice, or where did the baseline for this legislation come from?
The legislation came from a man called Mike Ewall, who was the one who heard about the Connecticut proposal and warned Albany County and the town of Queemans that this was a possibility. He's a trained lawyer. He's been an environmental activist for 25 or 30 years, and he's particularly focused on the management of garbage and landfills and the incineration of hazardous waste. So he's got a long track record of following this issue, learning about the chemistry, learning about the industrial processes, and he is the one who put together the law with the help of the town of Queemans and the town's own lawyer. So the town board and Mike and the town's lawyer worked on this law together, which was published last year sometime and had its public hearing in August.
So how is it possible that a local town can pass legislation on air pollution? Isn't that something that the state and federal, isn't that something that should be passed through federal and state environmental laws?
Well, there's something wonderfully unique here in New York. It's also true in Pennsylvania, where Mike Ewall is based, that we have a principle called home rule. And that means that the local authority, like the town of Queemans, can pass a stricter environmental law than the ones that exist at the state level or the federal level. They can't pass a weaker law, but our home rule gives us the authority to pass a law that has stricter provisions for environmental control.
And so what specifically kind of restrictions are we going to see in this legislation?
There are two kinds of restrictions that are proposed here. One is that anybody who wants to can burn rubbish here, but they can't burn a lot of it. And if they're burning more than 1 ton or less than 25 tons, between 1 and 25 tons of waste, they have to then monitor 19 different chemicals and compounds that could come out of their smokestack. So it's limited first in terms of how much waste can be burnt, and secondly in terms of the need to monitor the emissions from the smokestack that are coming from the burning of this waste. And so it ends up looking at 19 various toxins, including dioxins and volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides, and sulfur oxides. So it's various compounds that we have pretty good reason to believe can affect human health, especially causing cancer and other slow-evolving diseases, autism, multiple sclerosis, perhaps. The research is not great on this, but we believe it's a hazard we don't want to run in this community.
Well, you just mentioned some of the health risks that folks would face if they continue to incinerate waste, as well as some of the environmental effects. What is the opposition to this bill?
The opposition from the bill is coming from the Lafarge cement plant, who had a permit in 2006 that they agreed with the DEC to burn tires in their cement plant. The burning of tires for cement is something that began when the oil price and the fossil fuel prices were running up before 2007 and 8. And as they thought they were going to be facing much higher fossil fuel prices, they were looking around for other forms of fuel, not just Lafarge, but a lot of companies that were making cement. And they decided to start burning tires. So they began looking for ways of burning tires, and a lot of laws were passed that said it's okay to burn tires, and that this would keep tires out of landfill, and that this was a good thing to do. Now, it may well be a good thing to do, but if you're going to burn tires, I don't think it's unreasonable to say we want you to monitor what is coming out of the smokestack. And for the time being, we're going to limit the amount of waste that can be burnt in the cement factory or anywhere else, any other industrial process in Queemans. So if you're going to burn it, keep the amount small and monitor what's coming out of the smokestack.
I'm very interested by this idea of the, I believe it was 19 chemicals you said that would have to be monitored as part of this legislation. So I'm curious about the methods for actually monitoring that. Would this mean sensors going into the smokestacks or surveys being taken using specialized equipment? Are these the kind of monitors that they may already have?
As I understand it, and you're talking to somebody who's a humble geographer, not a chemist, there's continuous emission monitoring systems that are possible, that have been created. And they can monitor dioxins, carbon dioxide, hydrochloric acid, selenium, nickel, and various other compounds that are listed in the local law. Now, I think the difficulty the company has is that they see these monitoring systems as being expensive, and they don't want necessarily to have the added expense of monitoring these chemicals. Not only that, the law requires them to publish the results of the monitoring systems on a website on a regular basis so that anybody who wants to can look up how clean is the air coming out of this smokestack here in our town. So it's a way of assuming the machinery works and is available, then it allows the public to keep track of what's the quality of the air they're breathing as it comes out of the industrial processes that live close by.
Are there any myths or misunderstandings about how dangerous this can be?
I don't know. I'm not sure I would say that they're myths, but I would say, because I've been trying to track it down a bit, that the kind of research that's been done in this area is not very complete. So where you don't have really good comprehensive information that's been reviewed by scientists who understand the methodologies and can comment with some degree of knowledge about it, you have a degree of ignorance, so different people's beliefs then fill the space. So people want to say, well, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, of course we can burn it. It's better than landfill, which, landfill is not great. We don't necessarily want that either. But it's more a question at the moment of economics, I think. We don't have the information on a lot of this stuff, so people's own beliefs are going to fill in, and they'll put in whatever they want to believe. So if people want to believe it's fine to burn tires in a cement plant, that's what they're going to believe. If they want to believe it's very hazardous, that's what they're going to believe. The evidence is probably, what little I've been seeing, is more along the lines that it is hazardous, but we don't have any good, I would say, long-term comprehensive data on what are the health risks of some of these air pollutants.
On that note, Barbara, we're running out of time. For those who are just tuning in, when will this vote be held?
We don't really know. The law was sent to Albany County for review because the law is a bit ambiguous, but it seems to be something that the town should do. We expect it to be passed back to the town fairly quickly, within the next month or so. So I would hope that by maybe even the end of February or the middle of March, we will have a clean air law in Queemans, and it will be the first strong local law defending clean air in the country, from what I understand.
Sounds like something to strive for. Thank you for joining us, Barbara.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for calling.
That was Barbara Heinzen, environmental activist from New Baltimore, New York, speaking to us today about the town of Queemans' local law number 1 clean air bill. Listeners who want to join with Barbara and the community, please email fellow activist Christine Primomo at christineprimomo2@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us, Barbara. Hudson Mohawk correspondent Corinne Carey brings us a report from the state legislature as lawmakers return for their first full week of work.
I'm in Albany, live from the state capitol, where lawmakers returned for the 2019 legislative session last Tuesday, and in a historic vote, elected Senator Andrea Stewart Cousins to be the leader of the New York State Senate. Stewart Cousins is the first woman and the first African-American woman to lead the chamber. In her opening remarks, Senator Stewart Cousins promised that change was on the way and vowed to act on a number of progressive pieces of legislation that have been stalled in a Senate that has long been controlled by Republicans. There are now 39 Democratic members of the majority caucus and 23 Republicans among the first bills that were passed by the new Senate. Advocates celebrated the passage of a package of voting law reforms that add New York to the list of states that allow for early voting and same-day registration. Both the Senate and the Assembly also passed bills that allow for pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, as well as a provision to allow for mail-in voting and no-excuse absentee voting. On their second voting day of the session, lawmakers in both the Assembly and the Senate took up and passed the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, or GENDA, a bill that would add gender identity and gender expression as a protected class in the state's human rights and hate crimes laws, prohibiting discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, and other areas, and providing enhanced penalties for bias-motivated crimes. It was first introduced in both the Assembly and the Senate in 2003, but until this year, never came for a vote on the floor of the state Senate. I spoke with some of the longtime advocates for GENDA before the vote.
Ari Moore, from Buffalo, New York, a trans advocate since back in 2003, and a remaining advocate today.
What are your feelings about today and the imminent passage of the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act?
I'm elated. I am excited with a bit of metered anticipation. It's been, needless to say, everyone knows it's been a long time coming. It was a bill that was originally in the wording when SONDA was passed years ago. But I'm encouraged because now New York State has shown that it is truly progressive and a place of not just justice, but equality.
And SONDA, when you reference SONDA, that's the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act, and protections for transgender New Yorkers was carved out of that bill in order to get it to pass so many years ago, right? Mm-hmm.
You know your homework well, my dear. Also, we've been able to get DASA, Dignity for All Students, as well as Marriage Equality on all those motions. The transgender community had always been there helping our GLB sisters and brothers.
Is this going to make a difference for you in Buffalo?
It will make a difference for not just the state, but the whole East Coast. As you know, New York being the Empire State, it tends to lead in progressive and forward-thinking legislation and rulings. So I'm encouraged with that, and we look forward to see what the future has. As you know, we have a brand new Senate that has come in, and I'm very encouraged about everything that I'm hearing about them.
Julie Gray Owens, Gender Equality New York. I'm the executive director and board chair.
How does today feel for you?
Well, it's interesting because I've been doing this work now for 16 years, and people all around me are very excited and jumping up and down. I have to be honest with you, I'm going to wait until I see the fat lady sing, you know.
This bill, it feels like one step, but what are some of the things that the bill doesn't do that you think we need to pay attention to going forward?
Well, I would say that the bill is doing the job that it's supposed to do, which is to proclaim to New York legally and legislatively that it's not okay to discriminate against transgender and non-binary people. But that's it. That's what its job is, and that's what it will do. For us, I think that it sort of releases the hounds. And by that I mean now we can start talking about other legislation that's important to our community. For example, things like a third gender on licenses and also on birth certificates. Taking care of perhaps LGBTQ veterans who may have been removed from service because of who they are. There are 53 state benefits that they would be able to get if we pass legislation in that area, for example. So there's a whole host of work that needs to be done. We would love to see some type of employment program for the community where we would want to see people have the ability to get training on how to do resumes and how to do interviews, as well as help locating positions that might be available to them and training them on how to stay employed. Because that's obviously a big thing for our community. There is a need for homeless shelters, not only for children and teens, but also for older adults. And then we get into the whole issue of seniors of our community that are now going to be, in a situation where they need help and protection as well. So there's a whole host of things that are going to be needed, but I think passing GENDA opens the gates now. And I personally believe that there'll be a media crush right now, which is going to help advocates and also the general public know a lot more about us than ever before.
Sounds like today is not the end of a long battle, but the beginning.
Exactly, exactly.
Both the Assembly and the Senate took up several bills that would protect LGBT rights in New York State, including a ban on conversion therapy and GENDA. Senators from both sides of the aisle shared stories explaining their vote and commended Senator Brad Hoyleman, the longtime sponsor of GENDA. A number of senators of color remarked that the bill's passage on Martin Luther King's birthday was a significant step in the right direction for human rights. The chamber, filled with advocates who'd worked for many years to pass this bill, erupted into loud cheers and a long-standing ovation for senators who voted for the bill. The bill was passed by the Assembly for the 12th time by a margin of 100 in favor to 40 against. GENDA passed the New York State Senate on a vote of 42-19. I spoke with several advocates celebrating in the hallway outside of the Senate chamber about how they felt after the vote.
I'm Erica Lorschbaugh. I'm the Assistant Director for Legislative Affairs for the New York Civil Liberties Union. We're here today, and GENDA legislation has just passed in the New York State Senate. On behalf of myself, I'm super duper excited. As a genderqueer and gender nonconforming person, this legislation absolutely means the world to me. And on behalf of the Civil Liberties Union, this is, a parity that we've worked to achieve for years and years, so we're super thrilled about it.
Reverend Moonhawk Riverstone, I'm just an independent activist, been doing this for close to 30 years.
Where are you from?
Schenectady, New York, and I'm delighted, over the moon, no words, great, happy. It was awesome to be both on the floor of the Assembly and the floor of the Senate today to witness what was going on and to see it actually become a reality after, years of thinking this is never going to happen. And in a flash, it happens. And I love that that's the way the world changes. All of a sudden, boom, it tilts and it happens. And it's wonderful. It's also wonderful that, Dr. King would have been 90 today had he lived. Today's his birthday, and we did this on his birthday, and it's kind of like really cool carrying his message and what he intended for everyone forward on a day like today, so it makes it special.
I'm Sam Brinton. I'm head of advocacy and government affairs for the Trevor Project, which is the world's leading suicide prevention and crisis intervention program for LGBTQ youth. I am enthralled. I'm a survivor of conversion therapy. I've been discriminated against many, many times here in New York because of how I dress and how people perceive me. And today, that all starts to end. It starts to end. The conversation will continue. We have a lot of work left to do. The Trevor Project receives thousands of calls every single year from New Yorkers who are in crisis. And we're excited to say that maybe this will make those crises go away just a little bit. And that's a really big day.
In another part of the Capitol today, Governor Andrew Cuomo delivered his State of the State address and his proposed budget for 2019. He has said that he'll sign both the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, GENDA, and the bill banning conversion therapy into law as part of his 100-day agenda. I'll be back next week with a report from Albany, where both houses are set to take up a bill to strengthen and expand abortion rights.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey with a report from the state capitol in Albany, where lawmakers in both the Assembly and the Senate passed two bills protecting LGBT rights in New York State today. Corinne will be bringing us reports throughout the session to keep us up to date on what's happening in the state legislature.
This weekend, MLK Saratoga is offering an ambitious series of events honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, musician and activist Daryl Davis will be speaking and performing as part of the community celebration. He spoke with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce about his work.
Our country can only become one of two things, in my opinion. It can become what we sit back and allow it to become, or it can become what we stand up and make it. And I choose, you know, the latter option. We spend too much time talking about each other, talking at each other, and talking past each other. Why don't we try spending some time talking with each other?
So tell me a bit about how this works for you. How, you know, you talk about reaching out to people who fundamentally disagree with you and who you disagree with. What does that look like? Give us an example.
I have some background that many people don't have, in that as a small child, you know, I'm 60 years old now. As a small child, I was the child of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I spent a lot of time living overseas in various countries. Today, as a professional musician who tours this country as well as the world, when you combine my travels, I've been in a total of 56 different countries on six continents. So literally, starting at an early age, I have been exposed to a multitude of ethnicities, religions, cultures, et cetera. And all of that has shaped my perspectives, you know, from an early age. So, you know, diversity and a difference is nothing strange to me, whereby to a lot of Americans, you know, they're only used to seeing, you know, their own kind, or maybe some, you know, one person different or one difference, where I've been exposed to a lot. And that, I believe, it's what enables me to sit down and be able to talk with people who have fundamentally opposing views to mine, even violently opposed to mine, without, you know, creating a chaos or engaging in violence, because I've already had that background. And that is something, you know, that I, you know, well, I'll put it this way. Mark Twain had a quote that has gone on to become one of my favorites. And it's called the travel quote. And he said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." And I just find that, you know, so true. So I try to apply what I have gained from my travels in my conversations with other people. And surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, it seems to work. People seem to listen and they take it in. Nobody changes overnight, but I have caused a lot of change.
So in your bio, it says that your efforts to improve race relations would include, as an African-American, engaging with members of the Ku Klux Klan. Is there a story there?
There are a lot of stories there. There are over 200 stories there. You know, not everybody is going to leave the KKK or any other supremacist group. You know, there will be those who will go to their graves being hateful, violent, and racist. But I've had success with over 200 people leaving the Klan and neo-Nazis, you know, throughout my 30 years of engaging with dialogue. Because, you know, like I said, most people don't want to sit down and talk with these people. As you stated, a lot of people would say, you know, they would run the other direction. Well, you know, nobody is going back to Europe. Nobody.
That's all of this interview we have time for, and it concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Kleana Lightborn. Our engineer tonight is Jonah Moberg. Remember to tune in Tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.